TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Global Warming. Professor Stephen Schneider is the author of The Co-Evolution of Climate and Life, Global Warming, Are We Entering the Greenhouse Century? And most recently, Laboratory Earth. He was one of the first scientists courageous enough to take up the topic of global warming. When asked recently whether the current 100-year warming trend was likely to be caused by the greenhouse effect, he said the probability was between 80 and 90%. When I arrived at Professor Schneider's office at Stanford University, he had just gotten there on his bicycle. We spoke in November of 1998. How would you like to be introduced?
Well, I could be introduced as a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences, as well as a senior fellow in the Institute for International Studies and a professor by courtesy in civil engineering. And the reason for all this is not pretension, but to prove that institutions of higher learning, even excellent ones like Stanford, still don't have departments of problems where we actually solve real-world issues. We still have disciplines like biology and policy studies or engineering. And what I work at is the interface of all of them, because that's what describes the climate problem. Real-world problems like climate change and what to do about it and how it impacts people and nature involves integrating information from many, many disciplines, and you have to integrate it in an original way. You don't have to be original in the disciplines. And most of academics, people are original in the disciplines. As a result, we miss the opportunity to solve real-world problems. People ask me, what's the big deal about climate change? A few degrees, heck, one side of a mountain is a few degrees warmer or colder than the other side. One day is 15 degrees warmer or colder than the next. So why are we worried about a few degrees? And I'll remind them that if you actually drive up the mountain, you can see how the vegetation changes quite significantly as you keep going a couple of hundred feet higher, Well, that's because over the long term, these small degrees of temperature matter. In fact, one of the metaphors I like is if you take a sauna, pretty hot, right? Temperature of the air is around boiling. I mean, 100 C, 212 Fahrenheit's a good sauna. And after a half an hour, you have a vigorous workout without ever having to move. Imagine trying that sauna overnight. You know what you'd be in the morning? Dead. So exposure to large changes in a short period of time are one thing, but being exposed to large changes over a longer period of time are another. And the rate at which those changes occur are very important. Our ability to adapt and adjust to slow changes is pretty good. And that, in fact, is what the big argument in climate is about. At what rate can human and natural systems absorb change? And if the rate is very fast, then it's difficult to adapt.
You gave the example of glaciers and ice ages where a cooling and then a warming trend happened over a significantly longer period of time.
If you think about climate as a global event, we're not thinking just what happens in the North Atlantic region in Europe, but the whole world on an average, and you say, what are the big sweeps of Earth history? Well, in the last half million years, the big sweeps, the large changes, the massive things you'd see if you were a space traveler and looking at the Earth just with your eyes, is the ice ages and the so-called interglacials or warm periods. We're now in an interglacial or warm period. An ice age, where ice sheets literally came down across Northern Europe, across North America, through most of Canada, right on down. The last ice age was called the Wisconsin. Guess why? The ice got to Wisconsin. And I grew up on Long Island, and the South Shore of Long Island is a wash, sandy beach, and the North Shore is rolling hills, because the North Shore is how far the glacier got, and it sort of left its rubble in those rolling hills. So the ice age was quite spectacular and quite cold relative to what we know. But most people are shocked to hear the ice age was only about 5 to 7 degrees Celsius colder than an interglacial. In other words, about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly, colder than now. And that's because on a sustained global average basis, 10 Fahrenheit's a whopping big number. Forests moved thousands of kilometers. Species went extinct. It was literally revamping the ecological face of the planet, that 10 degree Fahrenheit, 5 degree Celsius change. Now, how fast did it happen? on a sustained global basis. We know the ice age was at its maximum about 20,000 years ago, and we know that by about 10,000 years ago it was essentially over, and we've had a very stable period of climate for the last 10,000 years in which human civilization evolved, and that period has a fancy name called the Holocene, and we evolved, the habitats we know are here, and the climate never varied more than a degree or two from its current value. Yet the transition from the Ice Age to the Interglacial took place in less than 10,000 years, maybe five. But when you think about it, 5 degrees Celsius happening in 5,000 years is a globally average sustained rate of about 1 degree per 1,000 years. That's relatively rapid for nature. We're talking for human impacts on climate in the next century of being lucky to hold it to 1 degree Celsius in the next century. And we could, if we're unlucky and or foolish, see it as high as 4 or 5 degrees in the next century. So we could see temperature differences almost the magnitude of an ice age interglacial cycle, this time being induced by humans, but not taking place in thousands of years, taking place in a century. And that very rapid rate, virtually all ecologists and others who look at nature say natural systems can't adapt, and human systems would have a great deal of difficulty adapting to change at that rate. That's the problem that most people feel about the risk of climate change if business as usual continues.
There seemed to be a difference in terms of how nature and humans adapt. And when I was listening to you, I thought, well, yes, some of us at least, you know, are able to put buffers between ourselves and nature in terms of shelter and cooling. But that in itself would lead to more global warming.
Well, there are really three things that people can do to try to deal with climate change, whether the climate change is natural or whether it's anthropogenic, which is the long word that scientists use, meaning caused or generated by humans. And first, you can make sure that you don't live so close to the margins that you can't tolerate any stress. If this were a world of 2 billion people, we had very ample amounts of food supply, we hadn't fragmented nature into smaller and smaller patches through deforestation and habitat use, I wouldn't be that worried about a few degrees temperature change over the next century. But that's not the case. We've got nearly 6 billion people tightly locked into national boundaries. You've got 1 billion of them living at nutritional margins. You've got fragmented habitat with species constricted to small ranges. That's the kind of world that's not very resilient. So what we've done is we've painted ourselves into the corner where the kinds of climate change that could occur through our own activities could be much more devastating than they would be if our world were more resilient. So in a way, the very objects that we use to improve our quality of life, the use of energy and materials and the clearing of land and so forth, ironically feed back and degrade nature in a way that threatens our quality of life. And what many of us keep saying is, can't we slow down the rate at which we impact the system? Do we have to have so many people getting rich so fast that we neglect the consequences of that behavior? And that's really what the global climate change debate symbolizes. The scale of the human impact on the planet and almost the avarice that we have to have more of us living richer and faster at all costs. And that is a tangible symbol, the global change, of that we may have to have some limits on the rates at which we continue to do what we do to nature.
Now, this question is sort of basic, but it's the answer to it is still so concealed because it points to certain industries. What are the main greenhouse gases?
Well, the primary greenhouse gas in the natural world, let me distinguish for a minute the natural greenhouse gas from the augmented one. The natural greenhouse effect is the sum of water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, ozone, and a few other small trace gases that allow about half the sun's energy through to the Earth's surface, but then block and trap and re-radiate back down to the surface 80 to 90% of the energy that otherwise would have escaped to space. This is not controversial. There is no scientific doubt. The greenhouse effect as a natural proposition is as solid a theory as there is in atmospheric science. Virtually nobody disputes it, the natural greenhouse effect. The debate comes along on the fact that this increasing number of humans wanting to get rich as fast as possible and use cheap technology, particularly burning of fossil fuels and the clearing of land. Remember, trees are filled with carbon, so when you cut them down and burn them, they dump the carbon in the atmosphere. Originally, it came from the atmosphere through photosynthesis. We're just putting it back at a very fast rate. So when we do these things, we build up one greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide. Now, it's not the principal greenhouse gas. Water vapor is. But the reason carbon dioxide is so important is it's the one we're changing. And what we do is we trap extra heat. Currently, we've added about 2 watts of energy over every square meter of the Earth. What's a watt of 2 watts of energy? A little Christmas tree bulb. Ever buy those little strings of Christmas tree bulbs, right? You've got 50 bulbs and they're 100 watts, so they're 2 watts each. Except this energy is not in wavelengths you can see. It's in so-called infrared wavelengths. And that extra heat is added to the system. Well, it can't not be there. It's there. So the real question then is, how do you distribute that heat? If it just warms up the surface, we should have warmed up, a degree or two already. Well, we haven't warmed up that much. We've only warmed up about a half degree Celsius. So something else is happening.
In 100 years.
In 100 years, right. So we're only going about half of what we probably should have. That sounds like good news, but it turns out that when we burn fossil fuels, particularly coal and oil with sulfur in it, we don't just put the heat-trapping gas carbon dioxide out there, but we also put out sulfur dioxide. And that's one of these eye-irritating, lung-damaging smogs, and they're very much related to health effects. Remember the London smogs that led to people to stop burning coal in London because they were literally killing people? And it's happening again in Beijing while the Chinese repeat the mistakes of the Victorian Industrial Revolution. Well, it turns out that those hazes, those industrial hazes and acid smogs, they also reflect energy back to space, so they cool. So humans are out there pushing the world toward warming through these greenhouse gases all around the planet and then pulling it back toward cooling in these pockets or regions where we have heavy industrial or transportation use of energy. So we're pushing and we're pulling and we're doing it in funny ways. And it's that combination that probably has kept us at about a half degree warming rather than one. The real problem is, as the Chinese and the Indians and others start to repeat that industrialization that we did, again using cheap and dirty fuels, which no matter how some of us scream, they seem absolutely bent on doing, they'll start pulling the sulfur out of those fuels simply because they don't want to choke to death. In the process, that means that we'll end up getting the full warming, not the warming, some of which is offset by these acid pollutants. So we're going to face the 21st century with the good news that they'll probably start to control pollution that directly affects health and ecosystems. The bad news is once you do that, you lose some of the offset to the global warming. We'll end up with a lot more of it than we otherwise would have had, unless we have the real good news, which is to transition away from fossil fuels and toward more renewable, more safe, if you will, environmentally safe alternative technologies.
So what do you think is the next step?
Charging people for dumping their junk in the atmosphere. The economists have a name for it. They call it carbon tax. And, oh, my God, the word tax. How is that politically acceptable? Another tax. But you think about it. If we don't charge people for dumping their junk in the atmosphere, it's not free. It just costs somebody whose climate is degraded or somebody who lives in a coastline when the sea level rises or there's a more intense storm or it costs all of us in terms of reducing the number of species in the world when they get pushed around by climate change, but now they can't migrate because they've got factories, farms, freeways, and urban settlements to cross. So there are real costs, the economists call this climate damage, from business as usual. But right now there's no incentive for people not to continue business as usual because the atmosphere is free. Well, why is it that my smokestack or your tailpipe should be free? Where does this free market logic that I keep hearing from political conservatives that it's a violation of our entrepreneurial rights to tax energy? Well, it's a violation of the market to have real damages done and not put the costs into the price of energy. So we have vastly underpriced energy. Energy right now, look at a gallon of gasoline. What does it cost typically? $1 or so? So that's 25 cents to 30 cents a quart. Well, go to the supermarket and buy a quart of frou-frou mineral water, and it'll cost you $1.25. So can you imagine the sanity of this world when the price of water is 3-4 times more than the price of an exhaustible resource like energy that we will need for the next couple of hundred years. It's outrageous, and no wonder we're building up so much junk in the atmosphere, because we've created an artificially set of low prices, particularly in the United States and in places like China and other areas where we subsidize this stuff in the name of protecting certain industries, but we claim it's the free market. It's not a free market. It's a rigged market. It's rigged to the status quo and to protect strong interests. As a result of that, the free sewer is building up and building up and building up, and now we're facing the prospect of substantial climate change because we don't provide adequate incentives for people to develop alternatives because the price is too low.
How does it get subsidized?
Well, it gets subsidized by not charging people for dumping in the atmosphere. It gets subsidized through research and development. It gets subsidized through depletion allowances. It gets subsidized through the highway program that puts roads out there, which then encourages people to buy cars. Cost of roads are not in the cost of cars. I mean, there's a variety of ways that we subsidize things. I'm not even arguing we shouldn't subsidize, because we subsidize mass transit, for example, because we don't want the crowding in cities. There are benefits that come from highways, like people get mobility and people get ambulance pathways. So it's not that subsidies are by themselves bad, but when these subsidies are invisible, unconscious, and we start hearing this rhetoric from people about that we have this God-given right to have cheap energy, that's nonsense. It's a political choice, and we have to make certain that we know what all the consequences are of the political choice. And I would argue that the consequences in terms of environmental damage are so severe that we have to reconsider this cheap energy strategy. Now, immediately people will say, wait a minute, you want to raise the price of energy? That's unfair, because poor countries like China or poor people like urban dwellers in inner cities in the U.S., they will pay a disproportionately larger share of their disposable income on the extra energy price than will rich people. So therefore, protecting environment is just a luxury of the wealthy. And that's the sort of argument you hear in Kyoto and Buenos Aires and also in the U.S. Congress from representatives of urban groups. Well, indeed, it's true that if you increase the price of energy, those groups will pay a disproportionate share. But they're also polluting. And my view is that you have to separate out the effectiveness of environmental action, for which getting the prices right is key, from the ethics of the equity problem, which is very important. You deal with equity through giving people the opportunity for what they need, which is resources and knowledge. That's not low prices. That's resources and knowledge. You don't subsidize poverty through artificially low prices of energy. You do it through direct transfer of resources. So if you were to increase the price of energy by an amount that would increase everybody's budget by X percent, but then you rebated that money to them by lowering the tax brackets, particularly for the poorest people or the poorest countries, then you'd be able to deal with both the effectiveness of the environmental policy and at the same time with the equity problem by returning to people what they need, which is resources, but at the same time penalizing wasteful consumption. The poor shouldn't be exempt from being penalized for wasteful consumption any more than the rich should. We have increased carbon dioxide to a level now that's about 20% higher than it's been in the measurements that we have over the last 500,000 years. Probably higher than it's been in several million years, that the rate of change at which we're increasing it is faster than it's been in modern geologic time, that we're doing that at the same time that we're fragmenting habitat through chopping down forests and forcing wild species into smaller and smaller and smaller patches. We're transporting species that never lived in one biogeographic zone, that is, in one part of the world, across mountains, across oceans, getting exotic invaders, the starlings that were released in Central Park 100 years ago because some jerk wanted us to have the birds of Shakespeare in the U.S. that have driven out natural species. This kind of problem combines with fragmented habitats and chemicals by the tens of thousands for which species have no evolutionary experience. And now we're going to change the climate at rates faster than they've experienced in modern times. It's a no-brainer to see that there's going to be an extinction crisis wiping out lots and lots and lots of species. The problem is, does anybody care? Does anybody value them? I think the answer is yes, many people do. But when valuing those species conflicts with the immediate jobs of small segments of society who know that the remedies are going to hurt them, they're organized. The beneficiaries, which are the vast bulk of humanity diffused throughout the world, people of the next generation, they either aren't here to vote or they're not organized, they're busy with other things. So even though you can show, and I think you can show very well, that solving the problem of environmental degradation and climate change can actually be a net benefit to humanity over the time frame of a century. The winners are diffused through society and in the future. The losers are organized and concentrated. They know it. They're advertising. They're paying lobbyists. They're buying off politicians. They're sending out distorted advertisements. And they're dominating the discussion. And the media is dutifully covering all of it as if it's a matter of balance. And therefore, it doesn't frighten everybody that carbon dioxide is increasing at an unprecedented rate, because they're hearing all this spin about how that's good for you.
We have certainly seen a quite dramatic series of extreme weather events. What do you make of those?
Let me explain briefly where the origin of this idea of increased weather extremes from climate change would come from. Every farmer knows that when you heat up the ground, you suck more moisture out of the field and have to apply more irrigation water. Everybody who's ever watered a lawn or been a gardener knows that. So if the world gets heated by adding greenhouse gases, as we're doing, and that's certain, we're going to evaporate more water, and that's virtually certain. Now, what goes up has to come down. So that means when the atmosphere is configured to rain, when you get the right convergence of jet stream and moisture flows and so forth, there's going to be more intense rain. It's virtually required, because if you put more stuff in, more stuff has to come out. On the other hand, what happens when the atmosphere is configured toward being clear and sunny and warm and dry? Well, if it's a little bit warmer, that's going to suck more moisture out of the ground. So theoretically, we've reached a forecast without even having to crank up the computer that we should expect on average around the world an increase in the likelihood of extreme floods and droughts because of the intensification of the hydrological cycle. Now, nature is very noisy. It's what we call background variability. So it's very hard to tell whether the wild extremes of the recent past are just nature rolling double snake eyes, or whether we've now loaded the dice and it's us that's starting to be responsible. So it's hard for a scientist to go out there and tell you that he or she is 99% sure that this is us in the game. And most of us say, well, it's consistent with what we expect, and that if we continue the trends, then the statistics will start to become completely obvious. That's why you'll hear scientists cautious. And of course, those people who want to deny will then grab that caution and say, you see, there's nothing definitive out there. We don't know anything. And it's not true. We know that the case is actually very strong. In the U.S., for example, we have about a 8 to 10% increase in average rainfall over the last century. That may just be natural accident, although it's completely consistent with what our computer models tell us should happen from the extra greenhouse gases. So while that's not proof, it's another piece of circumstantial evidence. But that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing that Tom Carl and his colleagues in the U.S. Climate Center have found is that the bulk of the increase in rainfall took place in the top 10% of intense events. In other words, the gully washers, the heavy rainfall events. This wasn't distributed in the light events and the medium events. Almost all of the extra rainfall was in the heavy dumps. Well, those are the flooders, and those are the ones that cause catastrophic outcomes. The Hurricane Mitch is an example of that. It was an increase in the heavy rainfall category, precisely the kind of things that has the reinsurance industry in a panic. Mariah, you said earlier that there were expensive industries that were out trying to protect their interests, and indeed there are. The fossil fuel industry is a $1 trillion industry, but so is the insurance industry, a $1 trillion industry. And then now standing up face to face with the fossil fuel industry saying, wait a minute, doing nothing may be good for you guys, but doing nothing may put us out of business. So there's a lot of concern from other groups, not just the fossil fuel industry, that maybe we really do have to deal with the commons, and it really does cost money. So I think that the weather extremes have mobilized a tremendous amount of interest in the climate change problem.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about the weather, because it's the one thing that really affects people in a most basic way, and that affects whole communities. And that could possibly, if the case could be made that this is part of it, could possibly actually change people's perception about community and common response and their own survival.
Well, clearly the weather, when averaged over a long period of time, is what the climate is. So if you change the climate, you're going to change the weather. The real question is, are we going to change the weather in a rather threatening way, like changing the extreme events. And I think that's a pretty good bet. Our theory suggests that'll happen. Early returns in the data are consistent with that, but it's not enough data yet for scientists to get out there, ring the bell, and say with certainty. My most recent book, I deliberately picked the title Laboratory Earth because I wanted people to understand the metaphor that science does not talk in certainties, it talks in probabilities. And this time, we're not talking about a cute scientific experiment in the ivy-covered halls of a college or in some glass-and-stone government lab. We're talking about an experiment with insects and trees and us along for the ride. And that gets back to human values. Do we want to take that chance of performing a planetary-scale experiment where the bulk of the knowledgeable community tells us it's at least even betting odds that we're going to have nasty outcomes and 10% chance of potentially catastrophic outcomes and maybe a 10% chance that it'll be good for us in that, and just take the risk? We're talking about irreversible changes to the life support system of the Earth. And those risks, to me, even though they're not certain, justify action. Problem is, it's very difficult to get people to act on something they don't see. If you're not conscious about what's around you, you can't fix it. Because if you can't see it, you can't fix it. And the problem that we have from this cacophonous media debate, the political distortions, the fax machines that send out all this spin to everybody, emphasizing the worst or the best cases, is it leads to public confusion. People are trained in elementary school at the beginning of their lives that the truth comes from the front of the room, the professor knows, the teacher knows, and what do I know? And all of a sudden, you know, all these scientists fighting, they don't know, how do I know? But what they're missing is that this is not an issue that's knowable on the time frame that we need the answer. We're not going to know with 99.9% scientific certainty about these questions before 20 to 40 years from now. By that time, the atmosphere and the oceans will perform the experiment and we and the rest of nature has to suffer the risk. So every human being out there is just as qualified as every scientist to decide whether to take that risk and how much current resources they want to invest to try to slow it down. But if you're scared off the problem because it seems too complex and you've lost your self-esteem in school somewhere to somebody who told you they had the truth, you're missing what the role of the citizen is. And the role of the citizen is to decide how to take risks. You don't have to know every detail. All you have to know from us in science is what can happen and what are the odds. What to do is a value choice. And if you don't become conscious of that role, it'll be very difficult for democracy to work. We'll be simply stuck with politicians and special interests, not governed by the people. The people had better take their responsibility seriously. And that means to put a little bit of time into figure out what can happen. And that's not going to be found on the two-minute sound bites on the evening news. They've got to look deeper.
That was Professor Stephen Schneider, author of Global Warming, Are We Entering the Greenhouse Century? And Laboratory Earth. He teaches in the Department of Biological Sciences at Stanford University. TUC Radio is supported by listeners like you. For the full 50-minute interview with Professor Stephen Schneider, send $10 to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call 877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE.
Whether the weather is cold.
The rap is by Dorian Johnson and Leon Rosen. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening.
Whether the weather is cold or whether the weather is hot, whatever the weather, we're in it together, whether we like it or not.
Whether the weather is cold or whether the weather is hot, whatever the weather, we're in it together, whether we like it or not.